This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
My colleague Jill Lepore is not only a great journalist here at The New Yorker, but she's a professor of history at Harvard and a terrific one, and we depend on her to actually know things. Jill, while Congress and the political class are slugging it out on a medical bill, it's worth going back to the history of this. Universal access to health care in the United States was first seriously considered in the 1910s, right? Where early healthcare activists were drawing inspiration from where?
Well, from their own experience in the U.S., the United States had all kinds of provisions for federal assistance after the Civil War. It spent a quarter of the federal budget on aid between 1880 and 1910, but especially from Europe, where sickness insurance had started in Germany in the 1880s, and in 1911, Parliament passed a National Insurance Act. And there was a lot of optimism in the United States during the height of the Progressive Era before the First World War that nationalized health insurance was pretty much on the docket in the 19-teens.
It was on the docket, and where did it go? What was its fate?
It went down into the trash bin of history to be long forgotten. So it really was by about 1916 that the measure had gained a lot of momentum. It had been introduced in a lot of states, especially in California. There was discussion in Congress. And there were a few different obstacles. The chief one that didn't affect the U.K. and the reason for the delay, so the U.K. had adopted the reform in 1911. In 1912, the United States began to consider it, but the U.K. doesn't have a written constitution. And our written constitution was a real impediment for progressive reformers, for all kinds of reform that was attempting to regulate the suffering of ordinary people under mass industrialism, that the Constitution hadn't foreseen that, and it was very difficult to imagine how to defeat constitutional arguments. People who were opposed to sickness insurance could call it unconstitutional. And so there was a question of whether or not there was going to be a need for a constitutional amendment. It involved all kinds of delays. So it really wasn't until 1916 that there was enough momentum to get kind of over that constitutional hurdle. And then months after that, the United States entered the war with Germany, and the people who were arguing against insurance were able to successfully defeat it by pointing out that it was born in Germany.
Well, this is it. There were claims that universal health care would cause the Prussianization of America, or that somehow insurance for all would give the Kaiser a foothold in California. What did all that mean?
It was just very effective political rhetoric is what it mainly meant. And you can see how effective it was because people keep going back to it again and again. And if you look at the whole century between then and now of this struggle, sometimes people say, oh, we're rushing into healthcare. We're not rushing into anything. We've been doing this for a century. But the arguments against it always are xenophobic. First, it's the Germans. Then by the time we get to the—
What does that mean, it's the Germans? What do the Germans have to do with us? I have to say this issue confounds me no end. Why? What is wrong with universal health care? Why is it somehow un-American?
It grants too much power over the individual to the state. So it's statism. It's collectivism. And what form of collectivism it is changes over time, right? Because it's a specious argument. So either it's socialism, sometimes it's communism. By the time Obama was elected, then it was just sort of vaguely European. And now it's actually liberalism. But remember that this debate started in the United States during the kind of heyday of social Darwinism. So a lot of the people who opposed national health insurance were social Darwinists who just sort of felt like, hey, if you can't make it, this is survival of the fittest.
Is there an element of social Darwinism now?
I think there is. I mean, there's a kind of laissez-faire, kind of reborn free marketism that is fundamentally socially Darwinist. And the trick there is how insufficient have been the arguments for the made by the advocates of national health insurance, because they're so easily cowed by these critiques of collectivism, as if republicanism isn't a form of collectivism, as if we are not tied as a nation by bonds of affection and community and solidarity
and institutions,
and sacrifice and institutions that bind us to one another, right? Like, that's how people could be so easily silenced. I mean, you can understand at particular moments, like World War I, okay, we're fighting a war with Germany. It's going to be really hard to get this through. You can kind of understand the heyday of the Cold War. Okay, if they're going to call it Stalinist, it's going to be tough for us.
Well, let's pause on that. In 1945, the Second World War ends. The governor of California is Earl Warren, who would eventually obviously go to the Supreme Court. And Harry Truman and Warren both try to institute universal health care insurance. Was there something about that political moment that made both men think they could win?
There were two things about that political moment. There was the prosperity of the moment and the hopefulness of the moment. There was the GI Bill and the support that had received. And GI Bill is nothing if not federal legislation that is essentially welfare for veterans. The idea that we have come out of the war with a sense of common cause, having defeated forms of collectivism and statism and cherished what makes the United States distinctive, the success of the New Deal reforms. Truman wanted to continue the New Deal with his Fair Deal.
Now, personally, I've always understood that the Constitution of the United States imposes upon the government of the United States a responsibility with respect to the general welfare of its citizens. And certainly, no one can pretend that good health is not a matter of first importance so far as the general welfare is concerned. That is why, ever since I've been president, I have recommended programs which I believe will provide better medical health and services for all our people.
So as I understand it, Warren and Truman run into the most unlikely kind of opposition. They were sunk by a pair of consultants named Leon Baxter and Clem Whitaker, who ran an organization called Campaigns, Inc. Who were Whitaker and Baxter, and what was their approach to politics?
They were both former newspaper people who had gone into the advertising industry at the outset. In the 1930s, they eventually marry. They're this incredible team. They're both pistols. They run a newspaper feature service, and they become incredibly successful running political campaigns as a kind of offshoot of their advertising agency. They run to the right, and they are hired by the American Medical Association when Truman announces his national health insurance plan, because their work in California defeating Warren's California health insurance plan was so phenomenally successful.
You know, Jill, the California State Archives gave us a transcript of a 1950 radio spot produced by Whitaker and Baxter, and we've tried to recreate it. This is what we imagine it sounded like.
The American people are registering their firm and outspoken opposition to socialized medicine. Public opinion is rapidly crystallizing on the crest of a wave of resolutions opposing any form of compulsory tax-supported sickness insurance. Today, more than 5,000 national, state, and local organizations are on record and have advised their senators and congressmen in Washington that they want no part of any paternalistic, bureaucratically controlled system of political medicine. They have emphatically stated that their members are against compulsion or regimentation in any field. The millions of citizens represented by these groups are a mobilization of free-thinking people who believe in the preservation of individual initiative and the American way of life. Today's private system of medicine has produced the highest health standards in the world. That system must be preserved.
What do you make of that, Jill?
Well, remember this moment, right? It really is the height of the fear of a worldwide communist conspiracy. So 1949, China becomes communist, Soviet Union gets the bomb, 1950, Alger Hiss, the Whitaker Chambers hearings, people are convinced that the United States, the American way of life, is under threat, that the Soviets are just about to take over, that the secret subversion of the American way of life at the hands of people in the State Department and in the federal government is part of a worldwide conspiracy. So Whitaker and Baxter very effectively play on those fears. And a measure of just how successful they are and also of how much people wanted this reform, the first thing they did when they were hired to work on the national campaign was go to Washington, and they talked to a lot of members of Congress, and they asked if they could look at constituent mail. And they read a whole lot of mail, and they found that Americans favored Truman's proposal 4-1 when they started. They had a huge $3 million budget from the AMA, and 9 months later, they looked at the mail again, and Americans were opposed to Truman's plan, 4-1. And that was pretty much just the money that they spent making their argument, which was that Truman's plan, it was sort of like a domino theory, right, that this was the first step in the descent into socialism.
So why did the AMA, the American Medical Association, which was for universal insurance during the Progressive Era, go to being opposed to universal insurance? What happened to the AMA?
Medical expenses rose. And this is actually the great tragedy of the long delay of the United States federal government in actually finally facing this issue, is with each passing year, the cost of medicine rises. And it's much more difficult to institute the reform, both because there's just more money at stake and it's hard to figure out where the money's going to come from, but also because doctors are making more money. And in the 1940s and 1950s, the AMA is hugely opposed because doctors are making a lot of money, and they would like to not have their pay limited by the federal government, by reimbursement, that's rates that are going to be set by the federal government.
Now, eventually, President Johnson was able to expand healthcare coverage in the United States in 1965, creating programs that are still very much with us, Medicaid and Medicare.
I'm so proud that this has come to pass in the Johnson administration. But it was really Harry Truman of Missouri who planted the seeds of compassion and duty, which have today flowered into care for the sick and serenity for the fearful.
Jill, how was Johnson able to pull this off?
LBJ flew in deer meat from Texas to feed to members of Congress at breakfast that he held every week to get them to pony up to his legislative agenda. He would meet with them every week with a kind of poster board on an easel and give them just an incredible Texas breakfast with big slabs of bacon and this and eggs and toast. And he would make this chart and he would tell them exactly what they needed to do that week to get through the Great Society. And he had this, you know, he had this urgency about it. He knew that he had a limited amount of time. He'd swept into office. He had the sympathy of people because of Kennedy's assassination. And he got through these programs that he couldn't actually really run, but that he instituted with incredible effectiveness, right down to flying out to Missouri to sign the Medicare Act in the Truman Presidential Library in front of Truman, who guy nearly wept. I mean, the beauty of that for Truman 20 years later, to see that this reform that FDR had tried to get through, that Wilson had tried to get through, that had been this long, simmering, lingering piece of American suffering was going to be addressed. LBJ knew what he was doing is the thing.
In this town and 1,000 other towns like it, there are men and women in pain who will now find ease. There are those alone in suffering who will now hear the sound of some approaching footsteps coming to help. There are those fearing the terrible darkness of despairing poverty, despite their long years of labor and expectation, who will now look up to see the light of hope and realization.
Well, we're looking at a situation in which people seem to not know what they're doing, especially politically. What do you make of the current effort to repeal Obamacare and maybe replace it with the American Health Care Act? Is it unusual for Congress to pass a bill which takes benefits away from people? Has that ever happened?
I think you might think about Clinton's welfare to work plan. I think very much that was pitched as a rearrangement of a set of benefits. The scale of this, no, this is its own particular crisis. I mean, what's, I think, kind of terrifying about this current moment is that the enemy is now no longer foreign. The enemy is within the United States.
Well, I guess it leaves us with the question, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the fate of universal health care? Has the argument to any degree, whether it's during the Clinton time or now during Obamacare, has the argument for universal health care coverage made any significant advance so that one day we might see universal health care coverage?
I think that Republicans in Congress are obviously floundering. They don't know what they're doing. They have a hard time talking about anything. But rhetorically, the Democrats in Congress are the ones who would need to step up for us to achieve universal health care. And they would need to reclaim an argument about the common good. They would need to be able to speak with the kind of universalism that of liberalism that animated Johnson and Johnson's more soaring speeches on this subject. And until they do, they cannot defeat even a weakened argument against healthcare.
Jill, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
My colleague, Jill Lepore. You can find her piece on the history of universal health coverage and everything else she's written for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org.